Over the last several months, we've been making our way through some of the great stories of the early Old Testament. At the start of this week, when I began to focus on today's great story, I felt a good bit of internal resistance. I found myself thinking, God, the point that this story makes is so basic, and I've preached it before, not the story, but the point. I'd rather say something different, something new and exotic that people haven't heard before. But in my soul, I sensed God saying, life's most important lessons are very basic and need to be repeated often. I sensed God saying, 100% of the people who will be at church on Sunday will have heard this point made before in one way or another, but only about 20% are actually living it. Those who are living it need to hear it again to be encouraged and reinforced. And those who aren't living it need to hear it again to be challenged and reminded. A couple months ago, I took our cat to the vet. As we walked in the office, I said, how's your day going? The vet said, well, not bad. But then went on to say, you know, sometimes it just gets so frustrating. So many people come in and see us and then don't follow our instructions. I said, oh, really? Do you get a lot of that? Oh, yes, he said. We even have a term for it, he says. We call them non-compliant clients. I chuckled and said, I'll have to remember that. He, knowing that I'm a pastor, said, do you have any of those? Oh, yes, I said. More than you would think. And we both had a good laugh. Non-compliant clients. Half the battle in life is doing what we already know we should. God gave us today's Bible story to remind us of an absolutely critical principle to live a powerful life of faith. So, let's start with a prayer and then remind ourselves. God, if we could only practice what we preach, if we could only live the advice we so easily give to others, we would be such mighty people. They say repetition aids learning. May it be so, Lord Jesus. May the core truth embedded in today's Bible passage sink deep and come alive, not in 20% of us, but in all of us. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. So last week we saw how God used Moses and a series of plagues to finally persuade Pharaoh to free the Israelite slaves. Picture it as thousands of Israelite slaves stream out of Egypt in a mighty caravan. Wait, where have I heard that word before? A mighty caravan of refugees on foot making their way north through the wilderness, looking for a safe place, looking for a space that they could call home. In about 2 months, these Israelite slaves find themselves encamped on the south border of the land of promise, the land of Canaan, about to enter into it. Jeff, you may say, wait a minute, I thought the Israelites had to wander through the wilderness for 40 years before they entered the land of promise. They did. But here's the thing. It didn't have to be that way. Amen. God's desire for the Israelites was that they would be liberated from slavery in Egypt, spend a couple months organizing themselves in the wilderness, and then move directly into the land of promise. Today's story tells us why that didn't happen. How the Israelites missed this incredible blessing God wanted to give them, and how we often do the same. as we pick up today's Bible story. Picture all of these slaves encamped in their tents on the south border. They can look across the border and they can see it. Anticipation, great expectation. What will it be like in our new home? Moses, for his part, picks one key leader from each of the 12 tribes of Israel and commissions them to go on a reconnaissance mission. Spies to slip into the land of Canaan, travel through the land, and then report back. Moses gives them these instructions, Numbers 13:17. Go up and see what the land is like, and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, whether the land they live in is good or bad, whether the towns that they live in are unwalled or fortified, whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are trees in it or not. Be bold and bring some of the fruit of the land. So for the next 40 days, these 12 spies make their way through Canaan and see amazing things. Verse 23, these spies, came to the Wadi Eskol and cut down there a branch with a single cluster of grapes that was so large, they carried it on a pole between the two of them. They also brought some pomegranates and figs. After they completed their reconnaissance, they came back and gave a report to Moses and to all of the Israelites. They said, verse 27, we came to the land to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. And they showed them the pomegranates, the grapes, and the figs. They told them how the topography was good, how the climate was great. There's plenty of water there. There are mountains, yes, but there's also lots of flat ground with good, rich dirt for crops and for livestock. There are people who live in the land, but not nearly so populous as Egypt. There's room for us in this land. And then two of these spies, Caleb and Joshua, were especially enthusiastic and went on to say in verse 30, let's go up at once and occupy the land, for we are well able to overcome it. But that was just half the story. The other 10 spies agreed. It's a wonderful land. But and there it is, the big but. Beware of big buts in the Bible and in your personal life. When you find yourself saying, it would be wonderful, but cross-check yourself. So 10 of these 12 spies said, yes, it's great, it's incredible. But, verse 28, the people who live in the land are strong, and the towns are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Dum, da-dum, dum, dum. You see, the Anakites were a race of really tall people. In the lore of the time, they, the Anakites, were believed to be the descendants of fallen angels who had mated with humans and produced offspring of unusual stature. The Anakites were believed to be their descendants, superhuman strength. Now, mind you, the Anakites, this tall race of people, were just one of at least a dozen different kinds of people who were living in Canaan. But to 10 of these 12 spies, it was like everywhere they looked in the land of promise, there was another Anakite, another giant. They go on to say in verse 32, the land we have gone through devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw in it are of great size. Not some of the people, all of them are of great size, and to ourselves we seem like grasshoppers, and so we also seem to them. So you see what's going on here, right? Two very different reports are being brought back by the spies. Joshua and Caleb were focusing on the incredible possibilities, while the other 10 spies were focusing on the incredible obstacles. And here's the thing. They all 12 of them, observed the same facts. The difference was not what they saw, but how they processed what they saw. Joshua and Caleb were seen through the eyes of faith, while the other 10 spies were seen through the eyes of despair. And guess which perspective prevailed among the Israelites? Numbers 14, verse 1. Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and all the people wept all night and said, "Would that we had died in Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Let us choose a new captain and go back to Egypt." So God, in effect, says, okay, I'm not going to force you. You have free will. You can't go back to Egypt. That would be suicide. I guess you'll just have to wander around in the wilderness for the next 40 years until a new generation rises up that has the faith to move forward. And there you have it. In a single story, life in a nutshell, the core choice that every single one of us has to make in life. If you want to access the beautiful grapes that grow in the land of promise, you have to be prepared to face the giants. In this Bible story, the grapes represent possibilities and the giants represent obstacles. Which way do you choose to see life? Which of these two perspectives dominates your way of seeing life? Which do you choose? And I deliberately use that word choice because it is a choice. How we choose to see life. A couple months ago, I heard an amusing story about a gourmet taco restaurant, I think it was in Seattle, that made a special promotional offer to its customers saying, if you will get a tattoo anywhere on your body of our restaurant name and logo, we'll give you free tacos for lunch for the rest of your life. Can you imagine? And here's the thing. So many people responded, they had to cancel the offer. The poor schmucks who already had the tattoo, right? They had the tattoo and they didn't get the tacos. But can you imagine? So many people responded, they had to cancel the promotion. If your favorite restaurant was offering free food for life, if you got the restaurant's tattoo and logo, how many of you would do it? Giacomo's? I don't understand you people. I don't see it that way at all. Of course, I'm a little bit old school, you know, and there are no tattoos on my body. Jeff, you may say, why are there no tattoos on your body? Because, let's put it this way, for the same reason you don't put a bumper sticker on a Ferrari. But I realize that most people these days don't see it that way. Most people see tattoos as an extension of personality and a beautiful way of enhancing the body. And you know what? I get that. I see that too. So I guess you just have to make a choice in how you see it. And what's true with that silly little story is equally true in the serious situations in life. We get to choose how we see it. Starting with life's most important question, should I believe in God? Is God with us or are we alone? Just like the story in the Bible, there is evidence on both sides of that equation. There are reasons for optimism and there are reasons for pessimism. On the one hand, skeptics raise important questions that every thinking person should wrestle with. Skeptics ask, if God is, why do children sometimes die? If God is, why is death often agonizing? If God is, why are so many animals put together in such a way that they have to eat other animals to survive? You ever think of that? I think of that often. If God is, Why is God so hidden from us? Important questions that thoughtful people have to grapple with. The point of today's Bible story is not that you ignore the giants. On the other hand, though, believers raise important points. If God is not, where does all of this beauty and complexity come from? Just look at the sky. If God is not, where does all the goodness come from? Like that police officer out in California a couple weeks ago who raced in to that bar to confront an active shooter and placed himself between the shooter and potential victims of that shooter, taking bullets, he gave his life so that they might live. Where does that kind of goodness come from? I suppose we could choose to focus on the shooter and the evil and say, where does that evil come from? Or we could choose to focus on that police officer and say, where does all of this goodness come from? If God is, why are there so many signs of God's presence? Like the story that I shared with you last week about that Ugandan man, one of 30 million who happened to be in just the right hotel at just the right time when the fellow we were talking about, Chuck, just happened to need that sign, and that was the one Ugandan who could give that sign. There they were, the hand of God at work. And I get to hear stories like that from you all of the time, the presence of God in your life. So we, like the people of Israel in today's Bible story, we face these conflicting reports, these differing perspectives. What are we supposed to do with that? I love what philosopher Rabbi Zacharias says. He says, to walk away from one's faith because of unanswered questions about evil is to walk into a storm of unanswered questions about good. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. You're probably aware that Arthur Doyle wrote a series of novels several decades ago about a fictional investigator, criminal investigator, what do you call it? Sherlock Holmes and his sidekick, Dr. Watson. They used their powers of keen observation to solve unsolvable crimes. There's a scene in one of the books told through the eyes of Dr. Watson. They're in this big house investigating a crime, and Holmes is in the parlor. And as Watson walks into the parlor, he describes what he sees. He says, Holmes walked past the couch to an open window and held up a drooping stalk of a moss rose, looking down at the dainty blend of crimson and green. It was a new phase of his character for me, for I'd never before seen him show an interest in natural objects. Holmes said, there's nothing in which deduction is so necessary as in religion. He leaned back against the shutters and continued, our highest assurance of the goodness of providence seems to me to rest in the flowers. All other things, our powers, our desires, our food, are really necessary for our existence in the first instance. But this rose is, for us, an extra. Its smell, its color, are an embellishment of life, not a condition of it. It is only goodness which gives us extras. And so I say again that we have much to hope from the flower. There are a lot of unanswered and unanswerable questions in this world. But I look around me at all the goodness and beauty and complexity, at the simple miracle of a rose, and I see the hand of God. And it's not just that. Remember the story I told you maybe 4 months ago now about Anne Lamott, brilliant Christian writer? I shared with you a story of hers where she tells about a friend who was a well-known artist and a raging atheist who was dying from liver disease from a life of hard drinking. He had become so angry, so belligerent, that he was driving all of his friends away. Then one day, Anne suggested to him that he conduct an experiment. She said, What would happen if you... Sorry there. That's all right. Go ahead and get it. All right. And we felt like grasshoppers as all the people looked at it. It sounded like a grasshopper sound, didn't it? So, a bird, okay. Well, I get my grasshoppers and my birds confused. In any event, I digress. So Anne is telling her friend, what would happen if for 6 months you simply lived as if God was? He was intrigued by the idea of this holy experiment, and he agreed to it. Anne says, before long, the transformation was amazing. He began having these wonderful conversations with his HP, his reference to his higher power, conversations that were just changing the very spirit that was within him. Before long, he was hanging out with his friends again, going for drives in the mountains, enjoying meals with them. Anne Lamott says, he became, quote, positively radiant. Finally, his life was working. To me, that's one of the biggest reasons for faith. It works. The essence of the scientific method is if you repeat something and get consistently the same result, you're on to something, even if you can't fully explain it. To me, that is one of the big reasons for faith. It works. Faith is what gets me up in the morning. Faith is what gives me hope when others say there is no reason for hope. Faith is what gives me the courage to face evil in this world and evil in myself. Faith works. Despair doesn't, so I choose faith. How about you? Jennifer Tatum tells a story about a time she was teaching her little girl the concept of words that rhyme. So Jennifer said, here's an example. Head, bed, dead. They all have that ed sound in them, and that's what's called a rhyme. Now, Ellie, can you think of any words like that? She thinks for a second. Sore, shore, store. Great, Mom says. Can you think of any others? She thinks real hard and then says, butterfly and worm. No, Mom says, though those two don't rhyme. Insistent, Ellie says, to me, they're both beautiful to look at, so they rhyme in my eyes. I love that story. So much of life depends upon how you choose to see it. Which choice do you make? Not just about life's most basic question, do I believe in God or not? Because once I decide I believe in God, I then have a million opportunities every week to choose to apply that belief to the nitty-gritty of everyday circumstances in my life. When you confront challenges and obstacles in your everyday life, do you tend to focus on the divine possibilities or get overwhelmed by the obstacles? Do you tend to see through the eyes of Caleb and Joshua or through the eyes of those other 10 spies? Do you see grapes or do you see giants? Somebody in our congregation, she was here in the early service today, about 6 weeks ago, experienced a real catastrophe in her life, a career catastrophe. She had worked at the same company, a healthcare company, for almost 30 years. And I mean, she didn't just work there. She poured herself into this job, rising through the ranks, reaching senior management position. Often she would work two positions for them when one was temporarily vacant. I mean, she gave 1,000% for 27 years. Then they brought in a manager above her in the hierarchy who decided he wants his own team and started forcing people out that had gotten great reviews and been there for years. It came her turn. She got pushed out. Unceremoniously dumped. After almost 3 decades, we got one more going. That's okay. Go ahead and get it, whoever it is. Let's see. What does that sound like? That was a grasshopper. All right. After 3 decades of working in that same company, she is unceremoniously dumped. In my first conversation with her, she was, of course, beside herself. Who wouldn't be? What am I going to do next? How am I going to make ends meet until I find the next thing? How could they do this to me after all I give them? And yet, in that very first conversation, she said to me, somehow I sense that God must be in this. I'd been with her in several small groups in recent years, and in each of those small groups, I'd heard her express a longing to find a better work-life balance. She had thought seriously several times about leaving that company because it so drained her, but she'd never gotten around to it because, you know, it's hard to make those decisions to leave a job you love and leave pay that is good and step out into the unknown. So she'd never taken that leap. She said to me in that first conversation, maybe God is trying to move me where I need to be. That's what it looks like to apply our faith to the nitty-gritty of our everyday circumstances. What good is it to believe in God in the abstract if I don't believe in God in the moment, in the concrete circumstances of my life? So she, looking at that fretful, frightful situation, she chooses to focus on the possibilities, not ignoring her grief, not denying the pain. In fact, it was her hope in the possibilities that gave her the strength to process that grief and then move on. And guess what? In a couple weeks, she starts a new job at a different company, a job that sounds like she's going to love, that has good pay and good benefits, and will give her the work-life benefit, the work-life balance that she has been longing for a number of years. How do you choose to see the difficult, the challenging situation? Do you insist on seeing God in it and looking for the possibilities? It was John Milton in his classic Paradise Lost who said, the mind is its own place and in itself can make a heaven of hell or a hell of heaven. This past week, I had a difficult conversation with my two sisters. Most of you know my mom is deep into Alzheimer's, and my dad, 85 years old, is still caring for her 24/7 at home, which is an impossible undertaking. My older sister, who convened this conference call between me and my little sister, my older sister has decided that it's time, that's got to change, and we're gonna make it change. Now, my sisters are wonderful, but we are very different personalities. My older sister tends to run hot. I tend to run cool. And my little sister tends to run on medium. So we have inherently different perspectives on how to approach problems. I find myself thinking of my older sister, why do you always have to catastrophize things? It's not that bad. She finds herself thinking of me, why do you always put your head in the sand? Wake up and smell the coffee. Imagine me running cool, huh? I mean, there could be a fire at our house, and I would say, maybe we should get some water, but don't panic. That's just the way God has put me together. And so we're having this conversation, my two sisters and me, about this very serious, delicate, difficult, fraught issue, and we're just not seeing eye to eye, and we're tugging on each other, and it gets so frustrating to me that it gets to the point where I want to say, where I'm tempted to say, oh, just do whatever you want. I wash my hands of it. Don't blame me when everything blows up, but call me, and I'll come back to help. You know those moments, right, in circumstances where you're just tempted to yield to despair and say, I'm done with it. Yeah. But what good is believing in God in the abstract if I don't choose to believe in God in the moment, in the concrete situations of my life? And so I consciously sort of drew myself inside myself back in that conversation and said, wait a minute. I choose to believe that God is in this conversation. Maybe God is using our very different personalities to weave together an approach that would be better than any one of us would achieve on our own. I choose to believe, as Wesley Egmont said, conflict plus love equals growth. Conflict plus anger and hate equals destruction. But conflict plus love equals growth. And so I said to myself, I choose to believe. How about you? As you look across your life, as you look at some great and difficult situation in your life, what difficult situation in your life today do you need to reframe through the eyes of faith? So much depends on how you choose to see it. One brief last thing before we close. We're just a few days away from Thanksgiving. One of the most powerful ways to train ourselves to see through the eyes of faith, like we're talking about today, is to practice giving thanks in all things. 1 Thessalonians 5:18 says, give thanks in all circumstances. Why? Because that is an incredibly effective way to cultivate the Caleb Joshua positivity that we're talking about today. Again, it's not about denying grief or pretending there's not pain. It's about seeing the good, being thankful for what is good, even in that which is painful, so that we have the hope and strength to grieve and push through our pain. Let me close with this. The movie I Am Sam tells the story of a mentally handicapped single father who operated at the level of about a six-year-old. He was allowed to raise his daughter Lucy until she was six, and then was forced to relinquish her to foster care parents. There's a scene in the movie where Sam and Lucy are playing together in the park and having a great time. Lucy is full of questions. Daddy, why do some men have bald heads? Sam is giving off-the-wall answers. Well, he says some men are bald because their heads are shiny and hair doesn't grow there. Daddy, she says, do I look more like you or more like mommy? Daddy, do you think mommy will ever come back? Well, Paul McCartney's, he lost his mom when he was young. And John Lennon, he lost his mom when he was young. He says, sometimes God picks the special people. Daddy, she says, did God mean to make you the way you are, or was it an accident? Now he's unnerved. What do you mean? I mean, you're not like other daddies. You're different. I'm sorry. No, Daddy, she says, don't be sorry, as she puts her hand on his. I love you. Nobody else's daddy ever comes to the park to play with them. Yeah. Yeah, he says. We are lucky. Are we lucky? It all depends on how you choose to see it. As we move into this Thanksgiving week, I challenge you to pick a difficult area of your life and take at least 15 minutes this week to think of all the ways you can be thankful, even in that situation, and then feel the power. Try it as a holy experiment. It works, because how we see life is a choice. Which choice will you make? Grapes or giants?